session number 11210, reel 9.
On what date and where did you land coming back home from your prisoner of war camps?
Maryland.
That'd be 1945.
Yes, we left early morning, changed planes, you might say, at Le Havre, flew across the Channel and arrived at the Westcott Aerodrome in Buckinghamshire about 5:20 in the evening. And there we were met by the Red Cross again. Boy, I never pass the Red Cross. I give them a donation every year. They were there to meet us. They gave us cigarettes and chocolate, you name it. They gave it to us. And, the WES too. Boy, they were there too with cups of tea. Very welcome. And then it was transport to a reception area near Haslemere, where again the Red Cross met us, and we were issued with Red Cross bags and all sorts of things. They really looked after us.
Red Cross bags, what
was things sort of, just a, more or less like we have today, I think, it's, if I remember rightly. Just something to put all our stuff in, you see. The Army issued us with a new kit bag, and I remember everybody had this new white kit bag, so you were easily identified as a returning prisoner because you got a, you know, you got a new issue sort of thing. and they sent a telegram home for us to our parents. Then we were interviewed by the Army authorities. We were issued with a pay book, you know.
You say you're interviewed. What kind of interview was that?
Yeah, you know, just your rank, name, and number, the usual paraphernalia. Slight interrogation, but nothing rigid sort of thing. I mean, there were so many of us in that sense, and
they didn't ask you about how you were treated, did they?
No. They went through all the formalities, you know, of your name, rank, and number, and all that sort of thing. And as I say, telegrams were sent off, and you had to sign or you. What medals you were entitled to, and what was the other thing? Oh, even voting arrangements. I remember I wrote all this down. That didn't take too long, and then we had a nice meal, a shower, and then to bed and what of the morning sort of thing.
The place you were in, was it an army camp?
It was an army camp by the looks of it. As far as we were concerned, it was a reception area for us.
Was it set aside for prisoners, or were there other soldiers?
I have a feeling it was, because there were literally hundreds of us coming back. And obviously they needed a place like this. And it was near the aerodrome, you see. Just hundreds of prisoners milling around. And everybody, you know, your one idea was to get home.
And how long were you there?
Just overnight. Then I think there were details put up, you know, those going north, Newcastle was mentioned. I think there was a train put on for us about 10 o'clock in the morning, I think. And we all trooped out, white kit bag and everything, and off to the station. It was a bit of an anti-climax for me, in a way. May I express sentiments like this? My mother, who was a real sentimentalist, and always envisaged me coming into Tilbury, somewhere like that, on a ship with all this ticket tape, you know, and picking me out and me picking her out. I envisaged coming into the house and putting my arms over my father's eyes and saying, guess who? You know, you have this sort of holy grail of this, and it just didn't happen that way. In fact, it was a bit of an anticlimax. My father had retired during the war. He was blind in one eye, and they moved to sea houses. And I forgot where they lived. I couldn't remember. And there I was stranded, literally, on Newcastle Central Station.
What time of the day was this?
This was about tea time, which I think... I remember one chap... this shows you how naive people can be, in a way, but I suddenly found my arm grabbed by this rather elderly gentleman, and he said... have you just come back from a prison camp? You know, I said, you know, I looked at my kid back, so the way he says, did you know anybody called Thompson? You know? It just showed you how anxious people were. Thompson, I said, there must have been hundreds of Thompsons, and there were, the central station was just a mass of bodies, you see. I must have looked very forlorn because I was standing there, and all of a sudden, Red Cross again. It came up to me and I said, I lost soldier, you know. So I explained my predicament, you see. I said, I think they've moved up to sea houses. This was my second home, you see. So VIP treatment, I was taken up into the station master's room by this very smart Red Cross official, rather elderly lady actually, sat in his office, a lovely hot cup of tea, and don't worry. And they made all the arrangements for me. They put me on a train to Chat Hill. I don't know whether you remember, if you've ever been up that way, but there used to be a little donkey engine ran from there down to sea houses. So now don't worry, because the last train was 7 o'clock, and they said there'll be a taxi there for you. All done by the Red Cross. Fantastic. And sure enough, I was put on the train, met at the station. And then I went to the wrong address. My middle name is Hughes, and they used to own the White Swan at North Sunderland, and I could only remember this, and I went to this house, and this lady, unfortunately, by this time, was suffering from dementia. She was into her 80s, and it was a complete anticlimax. You know, there was, and then it dawned on me, I had to go down to sea houses, so I went to sea houses. And my mother and father, by this time, of course, had received the telegram, knew I was on the way, and came out of the long stone boarding house. And we stood in the middle of the main street in sea houses. All the traffic stopped, and we just stood there. And, well, I think we were so overcome with emotion, we just couldn't speak. 6 years is a long time. And my mother had had a very tragic time. My brother died very tragically. And a year or two after that, I was whipped into prison camp. So I can visualise, now being a parent myself, I can visualise the trauma that my parents must have gone through. It was quite something. So it was a marvellous reunion. And then I settled into a routine. I put on a tremendous amount of weight. I went up to 11 stone 3 from about 7.5 stone. So it was exercise. I think I pounded the beach between Seahouse and Bambra every day. 3 miles there, 3 miles back.
How did the people around you receive it?
They were marvellous. I was fortunate because I got a double homecoming, because I went back to my old town, my old village, and got a reception there. And they actually included me in the, you know, they put on a party for us and all this. In one of the little institutes, you know. So I had a double, because it was my second home. I'd gone there since a child, every school holiday, and I knew most of the men that I'd grown up with had joined the Northumberland Fusiliers, who unfortunately were captured in Singapore. And it was a marvellous reunion for me. And then I just settled into a routine. I had a pass. The military pass. I think I travelled the whole country on this pass. All over I went. Then I had an accident. I fell and damaged my knee. I did this while I was a prisoner too. I had cartilage trouble and it cropped up again. So I was shipped up to Berwick Infirmary and treated there. But I really went all over the place.
How much leave had you been given?
Indefinite. I was never called back. I got home May, actually arrived in my own home, I think it was May 12th, May 13th, something like that. And I was demobbed December 4th.
So you, in effect, you were on that kind of leave for that kind
yes,
of time?
Yes, yes. And as I say, it was a good thing in a way because my health was restored. A rather funny incident happened too. While I was a prisoner, I think I told you, Hans Hager was my camp commandant. Now, he was friendly enough with me. He helped me a lot in learning German. And of course, he knew where how far he could go. He had his job to do and I had mine. But he must have got friendly with one of our boys. And I can't remember his name now. But he was a regular soldier. And his father had been a businessman, from what I remember. And he came to stay at the Longstone boarding house. And he actually was married from my father and mother's place. He married a Dutch girl, if I again remember rightly. And in the meantime, Hans Hager and he had exchanged names and addresses. And this letter from Hans Hager was forwarded to the Longstone boarding house and Sea Houses. And funnily enough, in between time, this man died. He had a brain hemorrhage, and we think, as a result of his privations as a prisoner, I can't prove that, but that's what we thought anyway. And this letter lay in my parents' place, you see. And it was my wife-to-be who we were courting then, engaged then, and she kept telling me that I ought to answer this letter. And I took my heels in and I said, no way. I said, you know, the war's over and that's the finish for me. But you know how persistent women are. And she said, well, I think the least you could do is to acknowledge that and tell this man what's happened. So reluctantly, I picked up pen and paper and wrote a short note to this chap. Now, the end of the story is quite remarkable in a way. In the meantime, poor old Hans Hager had been arrested by the Americans. He found out he was nominated in a will. One of his great uncles had died in the States and left him something in the will. But when he tried to do something about it, the Americans found out that he had either violated some immigration law or something had gone wrong, and they arrested him and sent him to 3 or 6 months in jail, which was quite shattering for him. But they said if he could prove that he'd helped an Allied soldier during the war, they would cancel it. I didn't know anything about this, and here my letter pops through the old letterbox, and his wife and I ate, picks the letter up, goes down to the American commandant's place, showed him the letter, and they released Hans on the spot. And that was how I caught up with him again, and, you know, I became quite friendly with him.
The leave that you had was a long time, as you said.
Yeah, from May to December.
What was the army doing about pay or compensation?
I drew my warrant thing every week.
Had you to have any medical?
No. At that time, no. No. The only thing I did on my own bat. Before the war, I had worn glasses for reading. And when I was captured, you know, I lost I'd forgotten they were in my respirator and I never saw them again. And my mother did manage to get some of these steel-rimmed army things sent out to me, which were a complete waste of time in some ways. So I thought, well, the one thing I am going to do is have my eyes tested at the army's expense. Why not? And I had to go to Fenham, and I was examined by a major there. And I remember he tested me and he asked me to put these glasses on, which I did. And he walked over to me and he took the glasses off me and he crushed them and he didn't see them yet. And this is 40-odd years ago. He crushed them in his hand and threw them in the newspaper. But it's a complete waste of time. He said, you'll be reading a newspaper when you're 100. And, well, I'm not 100 yet, but my sight is still fairly good. And I didn't really need glasses. So that was the only examination I had. Apart from going into hospital in Berwick, of course, they gave me a once over there.
You say you gained weight.
Yeah.
In what other ways had the long imprisonment affected you?
I suffered from migraine for a while. And then when I got married, well, I met this girl in Newcastle. Thought she was a local girl, found out she came from Chesterfield, but not mine. I knew then that I was 28 years of age. I hadn't worked in my life. So, you know, it was a crucial time for me. And I felt I had to settle down then, or else I would have become a rake. You know, I would have wandered, you know. My wife can't hear me, but I do owe a lot to her because, well, she accepted me, and that was it. And we were married in 1947. But then our son Will, she had a miscarriage, and then our son was born. But I had a bad time for the first three years. Terrible nightmares. I thumped her in the face one night. I almost broke her nose. And the climax came when I threw myself out of bed one night and I took the skin off all my ribs. I really did hurt myself and banged up against the wardrobe. And I went to see my doctor, who incidentally had been a POW himself. So we had a lot in common, and he said, "Oh, you're suffering from barbed wireitis." I remember that's how he described it. And he said, "The only answer is to get yourself away from your wife and family. Get a complete rest and change." And I remembered a Danish boy I'd met in 1938 when I was a student, and we'd become great friends. But I'd lost him during the war, of course. I didn't know what had happened to him. So I wrote to the Danish consul in Newcastle, and he traced this man for me. And I went abroad. I went back to Denmark for 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks. I came back a new man. I really did the trick. Didn't need any pills, no. That was it. I just got away from it all and met this man and formed a friendship which has lasted to this day. And it really put me back on my feet, and I've never looked back since. If I watch a German film or read a German book, then I dream about it. But I don't have a nightmare. But for about 2 or 3 years, things were bad with me.
There'd be no attempt by the medical services to kind of prepare you for this?
No. There was no preparation before when I entered the services. This is what... If I had a complaint, you know, they talk about escapes and this and the other. I still think we were there to satisfy the French. We were shipped across to France. We were very ill-equipped, ill-prepared, both mentally and physically. Well, physically, I suppose I was a fit man, but we'd been filled with a little bit of propaganda. The Germans weren't the only ones that shifted propaganda around. And if I am bitter at all, it was... we were wasted. I mean, there were fellows in our prison camp who were minors who would have been far better hewing coal at home, for example. You know, when you think of the Bevan boys and all this. I mean, I was a fully educated man. I could map read. I could speak French within reason. And there I was shipped into the DLI. No disrespect to the DLI, but I felt we were rushed into it in a way. Of course, we were young. We were kids then, really. We were fighting for king and country and this and the other. So you didn't think about them. But in retrospect, I still think there was a lot of talent wasted. I really do think it. Yeah.
And after the war, do you feel the same kind of frustration and bitterness because they didn't prepare you for the long years you'd been prisoner and, of course, coming back to civilian life?
I arrived in Westcott and I was home the next day, and I never went back till I was demobbed. In fact, I was a fully qualified teacher. You know, I had passed exams and I was a qualified physical training teacher. The war killed that because I smashed my knees up, and that long march didn't help. You know, and my health at the time in 45 wasn't all that good. So physical training was out in that sense, although in long terms it was a good thing in a way. Because promotion doesn't come easy in the PE world, whereas I became a head on the ordinary teaching side. But I got no retraining on teaching I went to school in Benfieldside, in near Consett, on December the 4th. The head teacher put a piece of chalk in my hand, and I was launched. And there was no in-service, in nothing. Boy, I spent one whole year getting back into the groove and bringing myself back to normal. It was hard work, really hard. It was tough. And I didn't get a penny made up, you see. As I said, I think earlier, when I left college, boy, I couldn't get a job. And I think I'm right in saying there were over 200 unemployed teachers in the county before the war. Jobs weren't easy to get. So that I collected my two bob a day, and that was it. And that's all I got through the war, and received the magnificent sum of £120 for nearly 6 years' service.
So was that the balance of your army pay?
That was my army pay.
Years.
So I still think there's a core of us in this country, many of them probably dead now, in the same boat as I. I mean, I met the sergeant who was in charge of our second camp was an ex-policeman. Now, he got all his pay made up, the difference between his army pay and that. And I think this was standard procedure in the forces, I don't know. But I certainly didn't get anything. Not a thing.
So you demobbed in December.
Yeah.
Where were you demobbed?
From Hartlepool.
And you just get a notification to go?
To go. And then...
And what happened there?
We got the usual suit of clothes and that sort of thing, and that was it, out.
Still no medical at all, no medical checks?
And I don't recall a medical at all, no. I had a strange experience there too, and this shows you the fortunes of war. Going from one room into another, I met this fellow. He was the other side of the door, and you know how you shuffle around. And when we opened the door, we looked at each other and realised that we vaguely knew each other. After all the formalities, we found out that we joined up on the same day. A man called Morley, I think he still lives in Chester Street area. And of course, the inevitable question, well, what did you do in the war? And of course, very humbly, I said, well, I didn't fire a shot, you know, and told him all about. That man was in the DLI. He got out of France, regrouped, I think, in Iceland, if I remember rightly. Went right through the North Africa campaign. He was in the Sicily landings, and I think he was in the Anzio beachhead or on that various sector. Went right through Italy. He was in D6. And went right to Berlin and was in the Victory March in Berlin and never got a scratch. Now, you know, what bigger contrast could you get? A nice fella, fine fella. He looked really well. But when we exchanged stories, it was just unbelievable.
Can you recall the actual routine of demob?
Not really. It was...
Were you measured for your suits or were you asked for your measurements?
Oh, yes. I wouldn't say they were tossed at us, but there wasn't a great deal of choice. And I think we got an overcoat, didn't we? We got an overcoat and we got a pair of shoes and a suit, I think it was. And that was it. But again, most of it were glad to get out. I think it was on the old golf course at Hartlepool. I remember we used to go down at the beach and pick sea coal to keep their bellies warm, or whether it was the clubhouse or what, I can't remember now. I think it was old Hartlepool, actually. But then that was it. I was out and into the world.
Is there any one thing you can look back on over your 6.5 years and say, well, that sustained me?
Well, I was a very fit man. When I got into the army, I would. That's what annoyed me too, because they kept telling me what the army was doing for me, PE wise, you know. And that was when I was put on a charge. I mean, my father, they just paid quite a bit of money to educate me, and I was a fully qualified physical training teacher. My second home was sea houses. I'd lived on the best of the land, and I was a fanatic for PE. In fact, I could have been a professional footballer, because I was approached by two clubs. And, you know, my father put his foot down there because my education came first and it was a rough league sort of thing. But, yes, I think my fitness more than anything else was a holy grail for me, because when I was a prisoner even, I was careful what... I used to go out in the woods even and pick wild onions, you know, what does the French eat? Oh, dear. Garlic. Because I knew greens were good for me. This sounds trivial now, but at the time, it was vital for me. Survival. That was it. I like to think that I kept a level head. I didn't do anything stupid. I couldn't see the point in it. Not the way we were situated. Yeah, I mean, I helped in escapes, as I think I recorded. But when I became an interpreter, it was pretty... I was so well guarded, you know, I was really... It was would have been tough for me to get away. And after 3 or 4 years, you know, common sense prevailed. I like to think so. Well, I've kept all the memorabilia, you know, I kept my diary, which isn't completely 5 years, but there are some interesting parts in it that people could read. My mother, bless her, kept all the letters and cards I sent, which my wife gets upset about because they're in an awful state. I should really catalogue them all, you know, and I've got all my pay books. I've got letters from my German friend. I have a very unique one here. You'd like to read it yourself, even. And this is the card that I tore out of my pay book and gave to the Toc Age people, who said they would try and get it back.
This was from the prison camp?
No, this was somewhere in Belgium. And
that was on your march, wasn't
it? On the march. We were actually trying to sleep in old First World War trenches when these men came in this strange uniform. We didn't recognize them, but I understood after they were Toc Age people. In the meantime, my father had had this bizarre interview with this fortune teller at one of these fetes, raising money for the Red Cross. And my father was a cynic, with a capital C. And when they told him about, you know, me, he said, well, he said, that's obvious. Nearly everybody had somebody in uniform or somebody who had been killed or lost. But they told him almost verbatim what would happen, that this card wouldn't be delivered by a postman, and it wouldn't come into the normal way. It would come across water. And that card arrives, my mother's written on there, and that's her writing, 11 months later. And it was shoved under the door in the schoolhouse 10 feet late. It wasn't delivered by a postman, and my father had to eat his words. And I've kept all this stuff. I've given talks on my POW experience. I got a bit annoyed by the film industry, who portrayed all these prison camps as all these old jolly fellows with scarves on their necks, jumping over horses and tunnelling, and altogether having a good time, being bored to tears. But prison camp for the ordinary soldier was not like that. I worked 14 hours a day to begin with, on a third of a loaf of bread and a bowl of potato soup with a bit of horse meat in it. But they never portray that. I'm not decrying this, these escapes. I mean, don't get me wrong, but I've given talks about this to tell people there are always two sides to a picture. We didn't have time. I think I said earlier on in my interview that we were so tired and so glad to get back to camp at night, you know.
The media hasn't really portrayed the other ranks.
I don't think so. I've seen Albert, the Royal Navy one, which I thought was very, very good, with a wooden horse and all these other ones, you know. But these were nearly all officer camps, you see, where, and I appreciate the fact that well, they had the know-how, and I think I'm right in saying many of these were briefed on what to do, procedures for making it tough for the Germans or escaping this. But we didn't get that. See, we were the early ones, and we were shipped right across the other end of Poland. That's a mighty long way from anywhere.
And, of course, you were working.
And we worked.
And I assume officers did not work.
No. Anybody above the rank of sergeant, I think I'm right in saying that. The sergeants in our camp were in charge of working columns. They didn't do any actual physical work. But I mean, I was 21. I was a student. I'd never worked in my life. And there I was, picking shovel and down 20-foot trenches, felling trees, filling skips with sand. It wasn't easy. At least, you know, it kept your mind occupied, if that's the best way. And then, of course, as the years went into the second year, life got a lot easier because we became organised ourselves. We ran football team. I mean, I played for England. You know, we had theatre, drama groups, libraries and something. Life became a lot easier, but we still had to work. And
what of the comradeship?
Well, I thought it was first class. You got your mucker, as I've mentioned earlier. He was your second one, you know, and you worked together. And then you were in groups. It was a drama group with footballers and something the other, you know. Oh, yes. There were little bits of upset, but by and large, I didn't see a lot of it. There wasn't a lot of bad feeling. And from that point of view, you know, it was an experience in a way. I mean, after all, I'm all in one piece. A lot of my comrades that I joined up with are lying out in the cemeteries in North Africa. You know, so I count my blessings in that way. I'm still here. But I am a little bitter about the way things were run at the beginning of the war. I know it was probably an emergency, but I think I could have been used a lot better, let's put it that way.